This is Glenn Duns, and medical editor with Australian Family Physician, and I'm speaking with Dr. Benjamin Cowie regarding his article on hepatitis B infection in the July issue of Australian Family Physician. Thank you for agreeing to speak with me, Ben.
Thanks very much, Glenn.
All right. Now, first of all, what is the burden and impact of hepatitis B infection in Australia?
So the most recent estimates that have been recently published for the number of people living with hepatitis B in Australia is that there's around 220,000 Australians living with chronic hepatitis B, which is a substantial increase on what previous estimates had suggested. So that's clearly, I mean, that's approximately 1% of the population. If you put that together with people living with hepatitis C, you're talking about, you know, coming up for well over 400,000 people living with chronic viral hepatitis. In terms of the impact, one of the most stark indicators of the impact of both hepatitis B and hepatitis C is the rapidly rising incidence of liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma, most of which in Australia is attributable to chronic viral hepatitis, both hep B and hep C. And that's now the fastest increasing cause of cancer death in Australia. It's actually risen up to number 9 in terms of causes of cancer death. And that's a very, very substantial rise in a relatively short period of time. So the impact is significant and increasing rapidly.
Okay. And who is at particular risk of acquiring hepatitis B infection, and who should therefore be tested for it?
Yeah, so there's a number of different resources and websites that go through quite a large list of who should be tested. I think the first and most important point is that if we reflect that approximately two-thirds of people living with chronic hepatitis B in Australia are people born overseas, in particularly in endemic areas such as our own Asia-Pacific region. So people born overseas make up probably over half of people living with hep B, and another significant group is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who, despite representing approximately 2.6% of the population of the last census, are estimated to represent about 10% of people living with chronic hepatitis B in Australia. So the two groups that are really identified in the National Hepatitis B Strategy, which was released in 2010, and in a lot of those resources I was mentioning, are people born overseas in endemic countries, particularly East, Southeast Asia, Pacific Islands, and also Sub-Saharan Africa, but also Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Now, beyond those two groups, there are a range of other priority populations, so men who have sex with men, people who have a history of injecting drugs, and others, but really those two groups, the people born overseas in endemic areas and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the priority for testing.
Okay. And what is the initial assessment for people with hepatitis B infection? What initial tests should we be ordering?
Yeah, sure. So once one's been diagnosed with hepatitis B, and I think to bring in an important point, it is important to systematically and opportunistically test people from those risk groups, and to do it in a way that really allows you to make the diagnosis. So not just writing hepatitis serology, but actually ordering those blood tests, because then you know if someone's actually got hepatitis B, or if they're immune through natural infection, and then they never need to be tested again, or if they're immune through vaccination. And if they're not, then they can be obviously targeted for vaccination. So I think that's one important point. But once a person has been diagnosed, there's a range of tests that or investigations. Once we've gone through the steps of actually explaining to the patient, obviously, what it means for them, and that it does require long-term monitoring, and that some people need treatment, the tests that we do, first of all, to establish what phase of infection someone's in. So what in the natural history of the virus, there's the four phases of hepatitis B, and that really determines both the risk of disease progression or the rate of progressive liver disease, and also any need for therapy to be implemented to prevent progressive disease. So to do that, the tests are to do E antigen serology, so hep B E antigen and E antibody, to do liver function tests, and to do a hepatitis B DNA viral load. And hep B DNA viral load is rebatable on Medicare once a year for anyone who's got hepatitis B. Four times a year for those who are on treatment, but everyone who's surface antigen positive is eligible for Medicare rebatable hep B DNA. So those three tests are how we determine what phase of infection someone's in, and therefore the need for treatment. But there are other tests to establish, for instance, the presence of any co-infections. So testing for hep C and obviously hepatitis D or Delta virus is important. It only infects people who are living with chronic hep B. And also HIV infection. We also test for hepatitis A because if someone's not immune, then again, someone who's already got chronic liver disease from another source should be protected against vaccine-preventable causes of liver damage such as hepatitis A. And then finally, there's the range of tests that are done to try and establish what degree of inflammation there is and the liver synthetic function and to give a suggestion of any presence of cirrhosis or advanced liver disease. So as well as the liver function tests I already mentioned, doing a full blood count and particularly looking to see what the platelet count is, doing clotting studies to look at their synthetic function, and then finally doing an ultrasound of the liver to determine if there is any signs on the ultrasound of the presence of cirrhosis or indeed liver cancer.
So there's the initial screening assessment, which, as you discussed, it involves tests for the antigen and the presence of immunity.
So the initial suspicion, if someone comes from a population that are potentially sort of at higher risk, such as people born overseas, then to order all those three tests, to do the hep B surface antigen, the hep B surface antibody, and the hep B core antibody, and if you write on the slip, query chronic hep B or risk of chronic hep B, then again, doing those three tests is Medicare rebatable. So you can get a full picture of what someone's status is with respect to hepatitis B. Are they infected? Are they immune either from previous infection or from vaccination? Sorry about that, I'll get rid of that. Are they immune either from previous infection or vaccination, or do they need vaccination? And to do those three tests at once allows the doctor to really put together a picture of where they're at and stops unnecessary repeat testing down the track.
Yeah. And so then subsequent, the next phase testing is basically to establish the phase of infection, as you discussed, and then further testing for the presence of co-infections and complications related to cirrhosis. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, that's correct. It's essentially trying to put together a bit of a systematic approach. So we've diagnosed someone with hep B, we've established what phase of infection they're in, which is obviously critical in terms of could this person need treatment, do they need to be referred, and then looking for the presence of either complicating factors such as co-infections, and also just to try and get a bit of a sense of where this person's at in terms of their liver disease using those other investigations.
In terms of public health issues, are there any particular issues that should be considered at the time of diagnosis?
It's a really good question, and this is something that I think from a systems point of view, we have a history of dropping the ball. The first thing to do is that this is a notifiable disease, and not in every state or territory, but in most, the doctor needs to notify cases of chronic hepatitis B as well as the laboratory. So that's the first thing, and this serves a couple of purposes. First of all, no system is perfect, and we certainly there is evidence in the past of failure of laboratories to notify cases of hepatitis B as well. But it also means we get a better sense of the epidemiology. If people fill out the enhanced surveillance information in their jurisdiction, then we can see what proportion of diagnoses are in people from particular populations, and it gives us a better sense of what's happening in hepatitis B in Australia. So that's an important step. But then the next step is, obviously, this is a vaccine-preventable condition. And so in all of the states and territories of Australia, it's recommended that people who are living with someone with hepatitis B or indeed sexual partners of someone living with hepatitis B should be tested to see if they also have hep B, and if they don't and if they're susceptible, to go ahead and vaccinate them. And that's funded in most jurisdictions. It's actually available free from the government to vaccinate in that setting. So that's another important public health thing to do, is to protect household contacts, but also to assess to see whether they also already have chronic hepatitis B. And we recommend that someone who, as most people are infected at birth or early in childhood, that they talk to the rest of their family and their brothers and sisters and obviously their parents, if they're, if they're around, to advise that they be tested as well.
And you also referred earlier to patient education. Are there any particular issues that you would emphasize on initial diagnosis?
I think one thing, this is a disease which is more common in people from culturally and linguistically diverse communities, and obviously, as I've mentioned, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So it is important that whatever discussion happens be done in a way that's appropriate and comprehensible to the patient you're talking to, and obviously using interpreters wherever necessary. But I think there's a few points with hepatitis B. There's nowhere near as much education out there as there is, for instance, like other bloodborne viruses such as HIV or even hepatitis C. So a lot of people have really no understanding of what hepatitis B is. the need for potentially lifelong monitoring is an important thing to emphasize, mm-hmm. that this is not something that's an acute condition. Well, by definition, if it's chronic hepatitis B, this is something that mm-hmm. they're going to be living with for many, many years to come. And the need to keep engaged with care, yeah. to have regular monitoring, to monitor for any change in the natural history is something to really emphasize.
Mm-hmm.
As is the fact that this is treatable, and that for people who do require treatment, the treatment is extremely effective mm-hmm. at reducing the risk of complications such as development of cirrhosis or indeed liver cancer.
Yeah. And who should be referred for treatment? Would you refer all patients diagnosed with hepatitis B for treatment, or are there particular groups that should be referred?
Yeah. So I think this is where there's a variety of opinions, and I should acknowledge that. My own opinion is that we're currently only treating a probably one in five people who need treatment for hepatitis B. That we best estimates are that only 3% of the 220,000 people living with Hep B are actually receiving antivirals at the moment. And the most conservative estimates are that we need to be treating five times as many people to be having an impact, or to be sort of getting treatment to those who need it to prevent liver cancer, etc. Do I think that we can do all of that through the hospital system? No, I don't. And our clinics already have many months and sometimes more than a year waiting lists. So I think what's important is to prioritise referral for those who, obviously, if there's any complicating factors, or if there's any evidence of advanced liver disease, any suspicion either clinically or on investigations of cirrhosis of the liver. But people who are in phase two or phase four, so that's immune clearance and immune escape. Essentially, this is people who have got a viral load that's elevated, so above 2,000 international units per mil when it's tested, and who have abnormal liver function tests, particularly an elevated ALT, they're the sort of people who we would be considering in general should need antiviral therapy and should be prioritised for referral and assessment, because they do need to get onto treatment. By saying that we should not necessarily be referring everybody to hepatitis clinics, though, that really mandates that improved support for general practitioners and for nurses in the community to monitor and to manage hepatitis B needs to occur. There needs to be education, and there needs to be support mechanisms to allow people to feel confident that they are doing appropriate monitoring of someone with hepatitis B and know what to do to react as accordingly. And that is, again, recommended in the National Hepatitis B Strategy. And the federal government has funded the development of a National Hepatitis B Curriculum for general practitioners and nurses to be able to do this.
Right. Has that already commenced, or is that something that's in...
It has. No, that has commenced. So the curriculum has been developed, and the education has rolled out in several states and territories. And that goes right through to the GP maintenance prescribing for hepatitis B antivirals. So now in New South Wales, and the education has already been delivered in Victoria as well, there's a number of GPs who have been trained to be able to prescribe antivirals for people living with hepatitis B. That's, I guess, right, that's at the pointy end. That's right through to the people who are actually going to be doing prescribing. But there are some things that I think every GP should be comfortable with, and those would include who to test for hepatitis B and how to do it and what to do about the results. I think... You know, 1% of the Australian population actually living with chronic hepatitis B. This is not a rare disease anymore. And there are those things that I think every GP should be comfortable with.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're getting into the treatments. What treatments are available, and how successful are these treatments?
So the treatments for hepatitis B have advanced quite significantly over the last 10 years. And there's two broad categories or classes of treatment. The first is the antiviral therapies. These started out with lamivudine a long time ago, back in the late 90s, but the problem with lamivudine was a lot of people become, their virus becomes resistant on therapy up to 70% after only 5 years. And we now have far more potent and agents that are much less prone to development of resistance on therapy. Those agents are entecavir and tenofovir, and they're extremely well tolerated by the vast majority of patients. It involves taking a tablet a day. And these are indeed extremely effective ways of not just reducing the viral load and normalizing the liver function tests, but there's increasing evidence that not only does it prevent further liver disease, but many patients will actually regress, and even people with cirrhosis, that subsequently their cirrhosis resolves when studies have been done looking at even paired biopsies, that cirrhosis is reversible on these agents for a substantial proportion of patients.
Right.
And furthermore, there's evidence coming through that they actually prevent liver cancer. And the most recent sort of meta-analyses and systematic reviews of this suggest that between 50 and 75% of, or there's a 50 to 75% reduction in risk of developing liver cancer in people who are receiving these treatments in only sort of 4 or 5 years' time. So these are quite potent agents at reducing the risk of liver cancer, taking a pill a day and dropping a chance of developing what is a very, very poor prognosis cancer by, you know, 50 to 75% in only a few years is quite amazing.
Is it possible to discuss cure when you're when you're talking about hepatitis B infection?
Yeah, look, that's a question that does come up, and it's a good one. So anyone who's ever, it depends how you define cure, really. Anyone who's ever been infected with hepatitis B, not just those with chronic hep B, but people who've got previous resolved acute hepatitis B, are left with tiny little viral mini-chromosomes, if you like, CCC DNA particles in some of their liver cells. Now, for the vast majority of those people, so these are surface antigen negative, core antibody positive, surface antibody may be positive or negative, people with previous resolved hep B infection, the vast majority of those will never run into any problems with hepatitis B for the rest of their life. In essence, the immune system has got permanent control. But it's this group that we worry about, well, this is one of the groups we worry about. If they undergo very profound immune suppression, it actually is possible for seroreversion to occur and for them to become active hepatitis B again. So that's an uncommon situation, but it's certainly it is possible. For other people who we treat, who are surface antigen positive, who have active hepatitis B, surface antigen seroconversion does occur, but it's uncommon. And for the vast majority of patients, you're putting them on a treatment that they will need to continue indefinitely to continue viral suppression.
And once someone has undergone treatment, or actually for anybody who's been identified as having chronic hepatitis B infection, what follow-up would you suggest in the general practice setting in terms of how frequently should they be tested and what sort of tests would you order?
So the sort of general, there's a range of recommendations here. In essence, someone who's on antiviral therapy, so I didn't mention before, the other broad class of treatment is pegylated interferon, and that has the advantage of having a defined period of time. It's used for just a year. But there's a fairly select group of patients in whom we would prescribe interferon to those who meet the particular criteria that it may work, because the majority of people, it doesn't actually ultimately work, and so we end up considering antivirals again anyway. For someone who's on antiviral therapy, in general, once they're established on that therapy, the sort of monitoring we do is every 3 months to do liver function tests and a hep B DNA viral load to make sure that the virus continues to be suppressed and there's no problems with the treatment adherence, so the patient's taking their medicines and the hep B remains under control, and also looking for the rare occurrences of development of resistance on these antivirals, which again is, you know, of the order of 1% over many years. So it really is a rare occurrence these days. We also need to monitor for the presence of complications. The HCC surveillance, so liver cancer surveillance, needs to continue in those who are eligible, even in people who are on antiviral therapy. So they need to continue having their 6-monthly ultrasound with or without our fetal protein for HCC surveillance. And, and there are clear guidelines on who should receive that sort of surveillance program, particularly those living with cirrhosis, people with a family, this is for people with hep B, those who have got cirrhotic liver disease, those with a family history of liver cancer, Asian men aged over 40 and Asian women aged over 50, and people from Africa over the age of 20. So those groups, even if they're on antiviral therapy, they need to continue their HCC surveillance. And in general, that sort of those are the blood tests we do. Once every year or so, we'll test the surface antigen to, just to see if they have seroconverted, if they have attained effectively permanent control of their hepatitis B, because after that, it is safe to stop therapy after a period of consolidation. The cessation of treatment on someone who is E antigen seroconverted, so someone who's in the immune clearance or phase two of hepatitis B, is a bit more controversial. We used to stop after a period of consolidation quite routinely, and that is still is possible and done, but we now know that there is a certain proportion of people whose viral replication will reactivate down the track. So we're still sort of sorting out exactly what the optimal approach is in people who E antigen seroconvert, whether we continue or whether we stop after a period of consolidation.
Great. What would you say are the main points that doctors should be taking home regarding hepatitis B infection?
So I guess I've touched on a few of these. The first is that this is not a rare disease. We're talking about approximately one in every 100 people in Australia have hepatitis B. And in some parts of the country and in some places where the GPs who are listening to this and nurses who are listening to this will be practicing, there's a substantially greater prevalence of hepatitis B, particularly in parts of the country where either there's a significant proportion of people born overseas, in particularly the Asia-Pacific region, or in services which see a significant proportion of people of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander background. So this is not a rare disease, and I think every GP should be comfortable about knowing who to test for hepatitis B, the priority populations we talked about, especially those born overseas in endemic areas and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and how to test them, what tests to do and how to interpret those. So that'll be the first point. The second point would be that unless we collectively improve our approach to hepatitis B, we'll still be in the same situation where we estimate 45% of people living with Hep B in this country, so more than 100,000 people, have no idea they're infected. They haven't been diagnosed yet. And that's part of what's driving liver cancer as being the fastest increasing cause of cancer death in this country. Because the tragic situation is if people are only being diagnosed with Hep B once their liver cancer is presented, that's far, far too late. So we need to know who to test, how to test, and what to do about the test results.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me. That's Dr. Benjamin Cowie. And thanks again for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity, Glenn. Thank you.